Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's 1946. 24-year-old Lolicelli is visiting her parents in Grandview Heights, Ohio, when she decides to take a bus into Columbus to buy some nylons. But her neighbors don't report seeing her on the morning bus, nor is there any record of her making a purchase at the store she planned to visit. Is it possible that something happened to Lola in the two blocks between her parents' home and the bus stop? This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, in this episode, we're talking about an older case, which we've talked about before. You prefer?
I prefer the older cases that aren't, like, super gruesome.
Yeah, the Cleveland torso.
Right, that was older, but it was not any better than a newer case. Like, I feel like there's some separation with the older cases, like, where I feel like, okay, that's happened so long ago, like the chances of that person who's missing or whatever, or their family, they're not around anymore. It makes it a little bit, like, not less sad, but, like, less current, so it's just, like, less of an attachment for me. But the Cleveland torso was still so gruesome that I don't think any amount of time would make that feel better.
No, and I think, yeah, those levels of brutality in that episode were hard to discuss.
They were.
So this episode is about Lolicelli, who was a 24-year-old when she went missing in 1946. I sometimes do still hear about her case, and when I do, it's called The Red Shoe Mystery, because quite obviously from that title, it includes a red shoe.
Just one red shoe?
Just one.
Is it Lola's?
Yeah.
Oh.
And again, her story isn't one that I hear about frequently, perhaps, you know, because of the amount of time that has passed. But I did actually recently hear her mentioned during a February press conference. Detective Adam Turner had been searching for a different woman called Mary Jane Croft Van Gilder, who went missing in 1945 from Ohio. And he was searching for her at the request of his family. And this sent him on a years-long quest. And this actually led to the identification and pending identifications of several Jane Does. And so he brings her up during this press conference. During this press conference, he makes clear that one of the things that stood in his way in his search for Mary Jane was actually other policing agencies. And, you know, we talk about that quite often. And he says sometimes he wouldn't even get callbacks to his inquiries as he's calling around trying to find out information about Mary Jane and looking at different Jane Doe cases. He said he was often told that there wasn't really any benefit in assisting in things like exhumations because the cases were so old. Detective Turner was also told essentially that no one would care about those cases because of the amount of time that had passed.
Okay, that's making me feel bad about saying earlier that it's less sad for me when it's an older case, but I don't know. Like, I think family members would still care, though. Like, I think people close to everything would still care.
Yeah, well, you know, part of what we do here is also, like, raising awareness about
it. Right, and I'm not saying I don't care. I'm just saying that it's
like
a little
less
sad. Like
the emotional impact.
Like some of those that we're talking about are things that happened, you know, 5-10 years ago. And I know that those girls or women are still out there and their family members are still there. Like children are living every day without them. But like, so I think that's what I meant with that. I want to clarify so I don't feel like a jerk now. But especially because I do think that they should still be trying to solve these crimes.
Right. So part of this press conference that Detective Turner did was actually talking about what he learned about Mary Jane, which is that she had left her family and started actually a new life elsewhere, and that her case is now closed. So they suddenly found out she had a second family.
Right? So she just, that was just her own choice. Nothing happened to her.
Right. But he had been looking at Jane Doe's under the assumption that, you know, harm had come to her.
Right.
But the other part of his press conference really was him educating the public both about investigative genetic genealogy, which is always great, and also emphasizing the importance of not brushing aside cases like this because they're older. After all, Mary Jane had surviving children who are still here, grandchildren, extended family members who just really wanted to know where she was.
Right, and finding that out I think it would make like quite a family mystery, like finding out why she would have just left like that. But it gives them some closure.
Yeah. So, you know, in a completely unrelated project that I'm working on, I've been contacted by a family member of a young teen who had been murdered in the 1930s. And, you know, his family never talked about it. And then he finds me, like, this researcher who's looking into it. And he was like, I'm looking for answers because we never had this discussion. But he knows that story exists, right?
Right.
Anyway, I was thinking about that and also thinking about Lola because I so, again, rarely hear her name anywhere. Now, it's true that a lot of Lola's family members have since passed away, so I don't know if there's that same kind of push for her as there was for Mary Jane. But also, I was also reading the book The Unclaimed by Pamela Prickett and Stefan Timmerans about what happens to unclaimed bodies. Now, these are individuals whose identities are known, but they aren't claimed for burial. And they have some beautiful passages in the book about symbolism behind saying someone's name and the way it ties to recognizing their life and remembering who they are. So sometimes I think about what we're doing here is a little bit of that, something like symbolic and a way of remembering them. So I don't know what, if anything, will ever change in Lola's story, but I also want people to remember her and hear about her. Now, just to give some landscape before we dig in, Lola Celli was a 24-year-old teacher who had returned home to Grandview Heights, Ohio, for what we now call the President's Day weekend in 1946. Her plan was to spend time with her parents and siblings. On Saturday, February 23rd, she told her family that she was going to go buy some nylons from a store in nearby Columbus, and she was supposed to catch a bus there and then come back in time for lunch, but she never returned home. And her disappearance has been an enduring mystery since. So before we talk about all that, though, I want everyone to know what we know about Lola. And there are so many Italian names coming up, and I can just feel like my Italian host's mom from thousands of miles of distance cringing at my pronunciation.
So do we just want to apologize in advance?
I try, like, oh God, I cannot roll my R's. Okay. I never could.
So let's take the pressure off you and we'll just be like, okay, it's okay.
I can still feel my host mom out there telling me how much I suck at Italian. Okay. She was born August 30th, 1921, in Vasto Giarda, Italy, to Michele Celli and Ida Franceschetti.
Franceschetti.
Shortly after, her brother Felice was born, just 2 years difference between the two. Now, Vasto Giarda is in the Molise region in Italy, which is between Abruzzo to the north and Apulia to the east. There are often jokes about this being forgotten, like a forgotten region, even among Italians, but the reality is that it's rural without many landmarks that are considered significant. Historically and currently, this area has struggled to maintain a population, and that was definitely true in the 1920s and 30s. Italian immigrants fled southern Italy and Sicily during this period to escape poverty, violence, malnutrition. And what this looks like in Lola's family is that her close relatives begin leaving in stages. Lola's grandfather, her aunt Gasparina, and her cousin Anthony immigrated to the United States in 1921, the same year Lola was born. A few months later, Lola's uncle Romeo left, and the next year so did her father Michele. That left Lola, her mother Ida, and Ida's mother Adelina in the small village.
Thank goodness for Lola and Ida.
Right?
We can say those.
Yeah. I think this might seem unusual that the women were left behind, but this was actually not uncommon. In fact, many would later say that southern Italy was largely populated by women because so many men had immigrated to the United States. Now, some of Lola's family went to Akron, Ohio. Michele, her father, settled with his cousin Florian in Connecticut. Unlike the rest of the family, Michele lasted just a year before returning home to Italy. Now, the family maintained this a few years longer, staying in Italy, but in 1930, when Lola was 9 and her brother was 7, the family left Vasto Giarda and traveled to the port in Naples. On the night of December 11th, 1930, they boarded the Conte Grande steamer bound for New York. Ultimately, their destination was Philadelphia, where Lola's uncle Romeo lived.
So they're not going back to join her dad?
No, it really seems like the family kind of split up once they got to the United States.
Okay. I see, because I have some, like, immigrant grandparents, and usually they'd send, like we were saying, like, sending the men ahead to get a life set up and, like, the house and the job and all of that stuff so that they could just send for their wife and kids, like, move right in and be already established.
Yeah, so it seems like they kind of split between, you know, Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah, which is why, you know, it does make a lot of sense that later on they would move on to Ohio after leaving Philadelphia. And once they're in the United States, Lola's younger sister joins the family in 1931. Now, by all accounts, Lola was an exceptional student. She was an honor student at Grandview High School, and after she graduated, she went on to Ohio State University. Now, I know someone out there, likely an Ohio State grad, will tell me that it's the Ohio State University, and I know, but they didn't start emphasizing the until the 1980s, well after Lola was there.
So she just went to the Ohio State University.
They are very into their the Ohio State University.
The and the. Yeah, yeah. That's so funny.
Anyway, at Ohio State, she majored in Romance languages and minored in home economics. This meant she could speak English, Italian, Portuguese, and Spanish. I just got the one and some rocky Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Her ultimate goal was to work as a translator for Pan Am. At the time, Pan Am was the leading airline and largely held almost a monopoly on many international routes. If you wanted to work in aviation, it was the ideal place to be. And I have to think for Lola, with her skills in language, this would have been a dream job. But despite having great grades in college, Lola did not end up working for Pan Am. Instead, in 1945, she was hired as a home economics teacher at West Mansfield School in West Mansfield, Ohio. There, she was to teach home economics classes along with, it seems, some biology classes. Now, West Mansfield was about 50-ish miles away from her family's home in Grandview Heights, which meant she had to live away from her family. She ended up boarding with a fellow teacher, Pauline Liebarger, at Pauline's family's home. So Lola lived with Mr. and Mrs. Liebarger, as well as Pauline. On weekends, Lola would take the train home to stay with her family. It was her first year teaching at this school specifically, and by the fall, she was already teaching her class of girls how to sew clothing and was anticipating a fashion show of their work. In November, she gave a short lecture as part of the PTA series, The Home and the School. On the surface, everything looked to be going fine, but later it surfaced that some things weren't so bright. A student would later say that Lola was taking medicine for headaches. Pauline, the fellow teacher Lola roomed with, confirmed this, saying that Lola's headaches were getting worse and worse and were more frequent. She said it seemed that Lola was feeling the stress of her job as a new teacher at West Mansfield. The weekend of her disappearance, Lola was heading home as usual. It was Washington's birthday weekend, what we now typically call President's Day. At this time, Fridays were the typical day off for this long weekend. Lola told the Liebergers that she wanted to head home early because she had a lot of things to do back in Grandview Heights. There was some assumption that this included seeing her friend, Dr. Anthony J. Melfi. Anthony had been in the hospital for at least 2 months at this point with lymphosarcoma. Now, Anthony and Lola met at the Ohio State University. They had a lot in common, notably both coming from Italian immigrant families, and apparently they would attend events together while they were in college. Pauline says that Anthony was the only man that Lola ever mentioned very much. Despite this, both her parents and his parents would later insist that the two were just friends. Still, the assumption was that she was going to go home and she would visit him while she was there. Now, this weekend, it starts off rocky. That Thursday night, the train Lola was supposed to catch was delayed by several hours. She could have gone back to the Liebergers' home and left again the next day, but she told Pauline that she didn't want her parents to worry. Pauline said that this was part of how she operated, understanding that people would worry about her. She would even call Pauline's parents to let them know when she was late or if she was going to be delayed in some way. So when Lola got home to Grandview Heights, you would expect from the way she had been talking that she'd have some sort of jam-packed weekend. She'd even said that she would send a note to her friend Anthony to let him know that she would be too busy to visit him that weekend.
Do we know what she was busy with?
Yeah, so everyone had made this assumption that it included seeing Anthony and doing some stuff, right?
Right, but now she might not visit Anthony.
Yeah, which is really extra unusual. At this point, I am guessing that it is clear that Anthony's health is not good. He actually dies on that Sunday.
He dies that weekend that she was supposed to visit?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. So he was not doing well.
Yes.
And she didn't go for a final visit.
No.
So what was she busy doing?
Okay, so despite all of this stuff that's going on, despite what she has told people, on Friday, she stays in, largely relaxing, it seems, and reading. The next day, Saturday, she actually does leave the house. She informs her family that she would be heading to Robert's store on the corner of Gay and High Streets in Columbus. Her plan was to open an account there and order or purchase nylons. This is her busy weekend.
That's okay.
Her mother also wanted her to look at fabric for curtains while she was there. And after she planned to go maybe look at some jewelry once she was done those things.
Do you think that like canceling plans but still not having a really busy weekend has to do with those headaches?
Yeah, I don't even know what is going on here. Like why she would be like, I'm so busy, I have to get home. Unless it was like an excuse not to stay at the libraries. I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean, you know, sometimes I say I'm super busy and really I'm just at home.
Now we all know.
Now you all know. You call me out.
Yeah. I think you called yourself out.
I did. But like maybe that's what she was doing.
Right. Or if you're not feeling good and you don't want to admit that you're having headaches, maybe you'd stay home and just try to rest. Or if you're just like tired, or maybe she's not, like maybe she's trying to avoid seeing her friend at the end of his life.
Which happens, right?
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's Saturday, and at 10:30 a.m., she left her parents' house at 1783 West 3rd Avenue, which, by the way, for my Google Street View people, it is such a cute house. And she had $60 with her, and she heads to the bus stop. Now, she was dressed in an aqua-colored dress with red trim and matching red suede Cuban heels. She was also wearing what was called a Bombay lamb coat, which was a gift from her brother.
She sounds adorable.
Like, yeah, and it's interesting because whenever we talk about what people are wearing, particularly in cases that are older, like, I don't think people quite realize, like, sometimes how colorful.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think it's something we think about.
Yeah, like what people's outfits were.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, I want...
The red shoes.
The red shoes.
You're in red shoes.
I am in red shoes. I love red shoes. Now, Lula had said that she would be home by lunch. So when 2 p.m. rolled around and she still wasn't there, her mother, Ida, started to get worried. Still, she knew that nylons could be hard to come by, so she thought her daughter might still be shopping. By 6 p.m., she was hoping that Lola had run into a friend and had got caught up talking. By 7 p.m., Lola's brother, Felice, was meeting all the buses coming back from Columbus, but Lola never got off any of them. Like many of the stories we share here, her family knew immediately that something was wrong. This was out of character for her. Now, her family immediately sprang to action once it was clear she wasn't coming home. I get the sense from the way the newspapers reported that her family's statements that they started to ask around immediately.
Well, right. You said that she was somebody who knew that people would worry.
Right.
So she was always very careful about that. And now she just hasn't come home, so. Yeah, definitely something is up here.
Now, her neighbor, Harry Lane, who lived a few houses down, was one of the first to offer some solid information. He was also taking the bus that morning. He said he saw her walking past his house on her way to catch the bus. What he said was unusual was that she was heading to the stop north of their houses when people in their neighborhood usually went in the other direction, south. He said that he took a shortcut to the other stop, and when the bus came, he expected to see her on it, Lola having caught the bus at the stop before. He said he specifically looked for her on the bus, but she wasn't there, and he had planned to sit with her. Now, the Grandview Heights police responded to this disappearance. Primarily, we're going to hear from Police Chief Robert Livingston, who led the search. Early reports were that Lola had not made it to the store she intended to go to in Columbus. There was no record of her either opening account or receipts for her. The other stores she talked about visiting also had no record of her being there. The conclusion immediately was that Lola had gone missing between the point that Harry Lane saw her and the bus. So a matter of a couple of stops.
Right. So he saw her in the morning, before she was supposed to go to the store.
So he saw her on the way to the bus. He gets on the bus. She's not there. There's no record of her going to the stores. Is it possible that she got a ride from someone else?
Maybe.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, of course. And that's something that's asked, but her brother Felice is very firm in his response. He says, she was one of those girls who believed it was wrong for a young woman to accept a ride. I know that no one could have induced her to get into a machine voluntarily. If she did get into an auto, it was under threat.
Okay. And her neighbor didn't see her getting into a car, but he did see her walking to a different bus station.
Yes.
So maybe she took a different bus somewhere else completely?
No? No. So like what they're saying and the conclusions that they're drawing pretty immediately is that between the moment Harry Lane sees her and that I think it's two blocks to the bus stop, something happens.
Okay. So it's really a short amount of time. And then within those two blocks too, that her disappearance would have happened.
Yeah. Which is, you know, something that is when I research these stories, the amount of time that it might take to disappear or the amount of space is sometimes just like so small, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we know that she didn't make the purchases. It doesn't seem that she said she was going to that day. She wasn't on that bus. Something happens, right? Now, Felice, he becomes kind of the spokesman for the family. He's got some clout here. He's also attended OSU and was a researcher in chemistry. And so his voice becomes prominent in the search for his sister. So we're going to hear from him quite a bit, too. Now, the Grandview Heights police start pretty close to home in their questioning. It's apparent that the family is being asked about Lola's character and well-being. Now, the family insists that Lola is a, quote-unquote, nice girl who would have nothing to do with anything wrong. They also made statements that she was a, quote, perfect girl, who didn't smoke, drink, and who had never been to any beer places and seldom dated men.
They're putting her up in a very, like, hard-to-attain place here, aren't they?
I know, yeah.
Like, there's a lot of pressure on this girl to be
perfect.
Yeah, and nice.
It's also, you know, it's always interesting, like, this, the both in her parents' statements, but also sort of in general, this like, how do you, like, you have to be perfect, right, for anyone to care, or you have to be perfect for anyone not to suspect other things.
Right. Know. So if she would have been like to a beer place or dated men, then maybe the police or other people wouldn't care as much.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's just,
yeah.
So on top of like having to live up to this high standard of being perfect, now we're trying to prove that she is.
Right.
Yeah.
But so police also, you know, they're not just going to take her parents' word. They actually go and question people at Lola's workplace. This is how they found out that she'd been having headaches, something that Pauline's mother and a student expressed. There's also speculation that she wasn't having an easy time at work. The superintendent of the school, S.Z. Migrant, did say that she seemed worried about her progress and success as a teacher, but that this wasn't unusual for beginning teachers in his assumption.
We'll be back in a moment.
Pauline weighed in on this nervousness as well, saying, quite controversially, according to our modern understanding of mental health, if she has gone on her own free will, it is because nervousness caused her to be abnormal.
So in other words, she has anxiety.
Yeah.
What we consider normal now.
Yeah.
Like, was abnormal then.
Like, everyone I know has anxiety. But yeah, it's sort of interesting here in that, I don't know. I don't know what it would be like. I mean, I do want to, it's like to have like big dreams, like her big dreams, like working for Pan Am and like being a translator and like all that. And then suddenly you're in a small town in Ohio teaching girls to sew.
Right. I mean, it does seem like quite a leap. But I mean, I feel like they're looking for anything here. Like, oh, she's got headaches. She's got a nervousness. She's like insecure about her job. But like, these are normal things that I think a 24-year-old is going to.
Yes, even in 1945.
Right. 46, at any point in time, these are normal things for a young woman to feel.
Right. But it is because of these headaches and nervousness. These play a central role in the early coverage of this case. Chief Livingston started saying that he believed her disappearance was, brace yourself, a result of amnesia.
Oh my.
This was something that her family pushed back on, saying that she was in good health at the time.
So as soon as we start talking about like headaches and anxiety, they go right to amnesia. So she was on her way to the bus that morning and then just didn't know where she was going.
Well, yeah. Okay, so
why would he say that?
Well, he doesn't say why, but there's a lot of comparison between Lola's disappearance and the disappearance of Ruth Baumgardner. Ruth was 22 when she went missing from Delaware, Ohio in 1937. Now, there's almost 9 years between their disappearances, but Delaware is just about 30-ish miles away from Grandview Heights. And Ruth's case was talked about quite a bit at the time. She'd gone missing from Ohio Wesleyan's campus. She was noticed missing when she didn't report to her classes and her room was in perfect condition. But her dorm key was found on a dormitory staircase. Her car was in the parking lot, but the key was in the ignition. There's a lot of talk at the time that she had suffered from some sort of amnesia, and this was really fueled the reports about, you know, she'd been seen in the days following, and so amnesia was talked about heavily with her case.
So this kind of, like, planted the seed in his mind about this.
Yes.
This kind of like when, a parent, you see some, like, your kid starts getting the sniffles, but then you see some awful news report about some terrible illness, and then you're right away, you're like, this is what my kid has.
Yeah, so it's like, oh, it must be amnesia, like that. Yeah,
we're jumping to this conclusion because we've heard about this. It's still in our head.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you, by which I mean not Vanessa, but you, our audience members, want a full episode about Ruth, let us know by emailing us at info@shegoesbyjanepodcast.com. I went on a huge side quest while researching Lola's story, and Ruth is still missing herself.
So you're saying that if they want to hear more about Ruth,
let me know.
Let you know. Are we going to do an episode about her in that case?
Well, if our public wants to know.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, Ruth's story's fascinating, and it's not being currently investigated, so, yeah.
Can I vote right now?
You can extend your vote. Would okay. you like to hear about Ruth?
I would.
Okay. So, anyway, this case, Ruth's, is, again, sort of one of the local missing cases that would have been on everyone's mind, particularly because they are both young, educated women. This talk does start to die down, at least in the press, comparing her to Ruth, also, saying she has amnesia, as the search for Lola starts to expand. By Tuesday, police agencies throughout the Midwest are being sent the details of her disappearance. Now, the Grandview Heights police force is quite a small force of just 4 men total, and that does include the police chief. The search for Lola has them maxed out, and all of them are putting in countless hours looking for her. Grandview Heights officials step in, like the city auditor takes over answering phones, you know, the calls coming in to the police station. And they also get high school boys to help search. By Wednesday, there are 175 high school seniors from Grandview and Upper Arlington who start combing the neighborhoods. They're all looking in quarries, along riverbanks, in ravines. Are unsuccessful in these attempts, but newspapers ran photos of these large groups of boys searching for her as part of her coverage.
This sounds like a more thorough search than a lot of the more modern stories you tell me.
Yeah, where everyone's like, whatever.
Yeah, like, oh, she ran away. Not a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we did the story of Sequoia Vargas where, like, it was the community members who...
Right, they did do a really good job, but they couldn't get the police on board. And
this is, you're saying this is,
the police are on board. There's only 4 of them total. They're all, like, in on this.
Yeah, everyone's looking.
We're all, like, caring at the same level.
Yes.
Sequoia's was very much, like, them versus us. Like,
exactly.
You know?
And in this case as well, like, they're like, oh, missing. And then they, like, tell other policing agencies across the Midwest, like, be on the lookout. So, like, they're on it, which I don't usually...
Which is nice.
Yes.
Yes.
So Chief Livingston also tells the press, we are considering every possibility, but so far we have absolutely no clues. She has completely disappeared. Around this time, it's heavily reported that police get what they're hoping for, and this is like one of their like biggest breakthroughs at the time. A motorcyclist, Cecil or John Scott, I've seen both names used, says that while he was driving along the Olentangy River Road on Saturday, he was following a man and a woman in a red coupe with a broken window. He said it appeared the two were arguing when the woman kicked her feet and a red shoe fell out of the car. He claimed he was unable to find this shoe.
Now I don't know what to think about the story. Because was she kidnapped or did she go off with this person on her own? Was it her even?
Yeah, and where's the shoe? This is why it's called the red shoe mystery.
Right, so we never found that shoe?
Well, police immediately scour the area looking for this discarded shoe. They stay on the scene until around midnight looking, but to no avail. So this shoe is not found.
And I'm sure there could be other women in red shoes out there.
Right. Well, this report does spur a gas station attendant to come forward. He said that he was working at the North High Street station, and this is about a mile from the Olentangy River Road on that Saturday. He says a red car fitting this description stopped, and a man and a woman were inside, and the man told the woman to keep quiet. The station attendant says that when the man went to pay, he gave him a $5 bill on $2 worth of gas and then drove away without getting change.
So this isn't looking good now.
Right. So they're like, obviously something has happened here.
Mm-hmm.
But they're unable to find any evidence. So where's the shoe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Saturday, this is 1 week after her disappearance, it's clear that this isn't going to resolve quickly. By this point, two Italian-American organizations offer rewards for a total of $500. And one of Lola's relatives, Joe Guardieri, says that the family will have to do some investigative work on their own. Over the weekend, there is some excitement as police and the media start to think that Lola's body has been found in the Olentangy River, but this turns out to be the body of another woman, Bessie Patterson from Republic, Ohio, who had been ill and had been last seen on January 31st.
I know this is not on topic, but do we know what happened to Bessie?
No, I mean, this is actually something that I see happen even now, where there'll be a report of a body found and everyone will be holding their breath, either being I hope it's, or I hope it's not, but it's still someone, right?
Right. I mean, the Gabby Petito story, when I was trying to look up what had happened to her a little bit, because I think I was at that point, the only person left on the planet who didn't know what happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
They were mentioning that they found 10 other bodies while looking for her. I'm like, what about them?
Who are they? Right?
Who are they?
Yeah.
So they're just darn it, it's not her.
Right.
But you still have a body.
Yeah. And so it's always happens. That is still a person, right?
Right.
So they're oh, that's just Bessie, right? That's not Lola.
That's Bessie.
Right.
Let's keep looking.
Yeah. So things are clearly tense. And at this point, police are saying that based on what they know, they suspect foul play.
Mm-hmm.
A car matching the description of the one the motorcyclist and the gas station attendant saw was reportedly seen in Twin Lakes in Delaware County. Now, this is over 2 hours away, but this car is possibly their one lead. So they dragged the lake looking for Lola's body. Again, with no success. Now, on March 10th, there's reports that she's seen in Ironton, Ohio, which is also over 2 hours away. A repairman at a stove repair company says that he saw her 4 days after she disappeared in a restaurant. She was in the company of a man who was about 35 years old. After this, a woman came forward saying that she had almost hit this girl with her car when she crossed an intersection on the outskirts of Ironton. Both claimed that she was still wearing her coat and those red shoes. Part of what made these reports so believable were that they detailed her clothing. And these sightings of her are still used today as evidence that there were credible sightings, particularly because they made clear what type of coat she was wearing. Something that everyone said wasn't reported in the papers before. But that's not true. Earlier reports did include that she was wearing a gray Bombay lamb coat. So to me, these don't have any more credibility than any other witness sightings after a disappearance.
Right. Because that was already detailed.
Yeah. So it was very definitely in the reporting. And so they're like, how did these people know about this coat? Well, right. It was in the papers.
But now anybody in those kind of pieces of clothing, they're kind of just being like, this is her then.
Yeah. Around this time, the police seem to come to a new conclusion besides amnesia or foul play. Based on the statements by an unnamed tipster, the new direction they're heading in is that Lola has been forced into a convent by her quote-unquote straight-laced Italian parents. Chief Livingston tells the press that he believed the convent tip is the best clue of any we had. Obviously, we only hear her parents' perspective on their relationship, but they're quoted in these early weeks talking about their relationship. Her father says she was so happy in her home here. She came down from West Mansfield every Friday night to spend the weekend with us. So according to her father, she was happy at home. And her mom says she told me Saturday morning before she left that she would be home for the summer and would be with Michele and me for a long time, indicating that in one of their last conversations together that Lola didn't indicate she planned to leave at all. Despite this, police begin their search of convents working on this tip, which I have to feel is also embedded in like anti-Italian sentiment, also like weirdness about Roman Catholicism. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I think maybe when they're saying that she's perfect and that they're thinking like if she wasn't, like if she had a slip up, oh, they're going to immediately like kidnap her off to a convent.
Right. But again,
they don't find her.
They don't find her. So the months start to pass with more sightings and calls, like a caller who claims that Lola is buried near a fence in a cemetery. But in July, there's one that seems maybe more plausible, at least in the media. A man comes forward to say that he's married to Lola and that they're living together in a nearby town and that she's expecting his baby. He says he's called the family multiple times to tell them this news and they haven't responded. And presumably this is why he turns to the media.
So they weren't listening to him at all? Like nobody was like, maybe we should go visit and see?
Yeah. So he's like, hey, I've tried reaching out to the family and nothing's happening. The press immediately speaks to Lola's brother, Felice, and he says that may be true. And everyone jumps on this statement thinking he means it may be true that Lola is married and expecting a baby. What he actually means is that it may be true that this man tried to call the house. The family had been inundated with callers. Apparently, though, Lola's younger sister later said that she did take a call from a man saying he's married to Lola and she's expecting his baby. This spurs the police to search marriage records in both their area and across the state border in Kentucky, where apparently a lot of people would go to obtain marriage licenses quickly. During this search, it was revealed that they had already done this when she first went missing, but neither search shows that she applied for a marriage license. In any case, her brother is adamant that this wouldn't be the case. He said she wouldn't have done that. If she did, she was forced into it. And also that if anybody called to say Lola was married, it would have been Lola herself.
Which is fair enough, I guess.
But, right.
Yeah.
But even so, there like must have been some nagging doubt, even for him, because a month later in August, he actually travels to the town of Circleville, where the man says she's living with him. He, along with the Pickaway County Sheriff Charles Radcliffe, go to meet this woman. And when her brother leaves, he says she only bears a passing resemblance to his sister.
So why would this man be like, yeah, that's my wife?
I have no idea.
That's so weird. Like, does he not know where his wife came from?
I mean, I think that there's just like so much weirdness in any case, right? And so, again, when people are coming forward and saying like, I saw her, mm-hmm. right? I'm always a little bit suspicious. But also when someone's like, I'm married to her, you have to be like, you're what?
Right.
Yeah. By this time, 9 months ends up passing since she's disappeared. The weight of not knowing is weighing on her family. They're quoted in the paper as saying, we keep on hoping, keeping our eyes and ears open. We still think Lola met with foul play. She was a healthy, happy girl. We don't think she was an amnesia victim. Now, of course, Lola's mother seems to be taking this the hardest, or at least is more visible in managing this. She spends hours praying for her daughter's return. Elda, Lola's sister, says their mother had started working in the garment industry again. Elda says, we thought it would be better if she was working, then she wouldn't be sitting at home thinking about Lola. But then months turn into years, and with some regularity, there's reports about leads connected to Lola. There are skeletal remains found in May 1949 when crews are digging a drainage ditch on the Olentangy River Road. But when these are examined, it's determined that they've been there for at least 20 years.
Do we think that's true, though, now?
Yeah, I don't know, like, what would happen.
By standards of looking? Yeah. I mean, that was 1949, so...
Yeah, like what would happen with modern technology? I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's also a man who left his wife in Ohio shortly after Lola disappeared, and the wife reports to police that she thought he could be involved, and that turned out not to be a thing. Mm-hmm. Like how to get back at your ex.
Right. This is very big revenge.
Yeah. In 1955, there was an unmarked grave noted in the Darby Baptist Church Cemetery in Canaan Township, and there were reports that this could be her, particularly because two farmers said that they were asked by a stranger to help dig a grave. This turns out to be a really complicated mix-up, and when they exhume the remains, they're quickly identified as a young man, and later it's connected that he was someone who had died from what sounds like carbon monoxide poisoning.
They're finding all kinds of things stuff along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Then in 1956, there is a startling development in Lola's case. Chief Livingston goes public with new information. First, he says that one of the original investigators on the case, John Guy, knows details about her disappearance, and that these were details were one that John Guy could not reveal because he had been sworn to secrecy. But Chief Livingston says that Guy revealed enough to suggest that Lola is, in fact, still alive.
Really?
Yeah, and now when this goes to press, Lola's brother Felice, they ask him about this, and he says, "We want to believe she's alive, but will not be convinced until we receive proof." And when he says this, he says that he would like to speak to John Guy about this himself. Now, furthermore, Felice says, "Neither John Guy nor Chief Livingston has contacted us since August 1946. You would think they'd tell us who are most concerned if they know anything."
Could it be possible that, like, Lola herself asked them not to say anything?
Well,
like, say just, you know, possibly that, like, her she wasn't getting along with her family or for one reason or another, like, and was trying to actually just leave them.
Like, communicate in some
yeah.
way. Yeah. So this is coming out. John Guy's got information, right? But her brother is just, like, so frustrated because, like, they have not actually spoken to the police investigators since 1946.
Right.
So
that 10 years later here.
Yeah, yeah. Like, all of those searches, all of those remains being found, the police had not once contacted the family to let them know what was happening. They likely read about it alongside the rest of the public in the papers. Felice says that even the year before 1955, police had gone to speak to a woman who may have been Lola in Chicago without informing the family, and he asserts who, besides the family, would be best at identifying her. Shortly after this, the chief makes more statements alongside the Grandview Heights mayor, A.K. Pierce. Mayor Pierce says that if Chief Livingston is confident in John Guy's report, that Lola's case should be closed. And Livingston said, "I've known John Guy for 50 years and I'm willing to accept his word." He also says that he doesn't feel the need to press Guy for more detailed information because they have no evidence of foul play. And so Lola's case is officially closed in August 1956. But you'll notice in this, we've heard from the mayor, we've heard from the police chief, and Lola's brother, but there's someone we haven't heard from at all, and that's John Guy himself.
And why?
He's on vacation, Vanessa.
Okay.
And basically, when he rolls into town and he's asked about this, he says essentially, "Whoa, wait a minute. That's a gross misrepresentation of what I said." And he goes on to explain that what he was really trying to say was that he believed that soon more information would come out about Lola's disappearance.
Oh my gosh. So he didn't say, "Oh yeah, she's definitely alive. I just can't
tell you where.
So he never said any of that.
That seems
so in my head, I'm making here. Up this whole thing of, like, maybe her family was abusive and they put her in some sort of, like, witness protection type thing and, like, sent her off with a new name and he knows where she is, but he's not. All that just went out the window.
Yes.
Yes.
And like, that has been the story of Lola's story, right? It's like, there is such few details, right?
That
right. It does invite people to be, like, constructing things, like, maybe this is what happened.
Yeah.
And clearly the police themselves had been doing that along. Like, we've got, she was an amnesia victim. It was foul play. She's
married to some guy.
She's married to some guy. Like,
then the shoes and the jacket. And
she's, like, been forced into a convent, right? Yep. Like, she's run away. You know, like, they have really just bought into any story. So there's, like, feels like there's very little investigative work. They did so good early on, like, just searching physically for
right.
her.
Right. They're just looking for her, but actually putting together the pieces and figuring out what happened.
Not happening.
No.
So, anyway, nothing is resolved.
Right.
And even though Lola's case gets reopened shortly after, interest in what happened to her does fade. And by 1956, her story, again, fades from the media, unless it's kind of in retrospectives of that era. She's now been missing for 78 years, and I don't know what will happen in her case, but I did want you all to hear her story and know her name. We're now going to hear my poem, Surrender Dorothy, from my book, Doe. Surrender Dorothy, Lola Celli, 24, missing since February 23rd, 1946, from Grandview Heights, Ohio. The name of the star was Sorrow, but her tongue caught no dust, no whirling tumbleweeds stuck deep in her throat. What if she didn't want to see?
other lands, big mountains, big oceans, except through the glass light beneath Marvel's hands. She wouldn't have plucked an apple from beneath glimmering leaves while a toucan watched the way her lips moved over its flesh, or caressed the lockjaw of a man without heart enough not to yield an axe. When the hand of God reached to hold her own, she wouldn't have fought with her eyes closed or slid off the edge of the screen into technicolor spaces we only see in the poppy-drunk dawn. She would have left those ruby-red slippers on the road through the nightmare forest, evidence that hearts will never be practical until they can be made unbreakable.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.